Salma Weiss and Gabriel Denman interviewing Dr. Steve Fenves. It's May 10th, 1996, and this is tape number two. We stopped last week when you were talking about going to the United States from Paris.
Yes.
And you mentioned that your cousins were going to go to South America, and you were going to thinking about the United States. So we'll start from there.
All right.
Okay, so tell us.
Well, by the summer of 1950, we had lived 3 years in Paris. My sister was a irregular student at the Sorbonne, expecting to be accepted as a full-time student. I had finished the French baccalaureate, and I was preparing for the entrance exam at the École des Beaux-Arts. I was, at that time, I was thinking about going into architecture. So when the our quota number came and our immigration permit came, we were debating for some time whether to go or not, but eventually we decided to come to the States, and I haven't regretted it. Neither of us have regretted it. So highest paid for our travel.
Who paid for
it? Hyas, Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society.
Okay.
On a old rickety boat with lots of American college students returning from summer in Europe. So we arrived in New York. Friends of our parents met us there and put us up for several weeks, and then Hyas sent us on to Chicago because our uncle lived there. By that time, my uncle was very ill, and he was not in a position to help us in any way. Other friends of our parents sort of took care of us. Both got rooms, and I started working at the recommendation of a engineer that I met. I got a job in an engineering firm and decided that I didn't want to continue in architecture, that I was interested in civil engineering. And so I started going to night school at Illinois Institute of Technology in Chicago. And I had planned it that in going to night school in 7 years, I was going to get my bachelor's degree. That was, of course, the Korean War, and 15 months after coming to the States, I got my greetings, and I was drafted. Went through basic training in Camp Breckinridge, Kentucky. Had my orders for Korea, and I was wondering what it would be like to have a weapon to shoot back. I was not happy about going, but I wasn't terribly unhappy either. At the very last minute, my orders were changed, and I was shipped to Germany as an interpreter. I had passed the tests for Hungarian, Serbian, German, and French interpreter. So I got assigned to an intelligence battalion in Stuttgart, attached to 7th Army headquarters. And after 3 or 4 weeks, the executive officer called me in and said, "Soldier, since you're not a citizen, we can't get security clearance for you. We can't use you in this company. The normal procedure is to send you to infantry. You look a little more intelligent than that. What else can you do?" So I said, "Well, sir, in addition to all these translator tests, I also passed the test for draftsman, and if you could find me a draftsman position as an engineering draftsman, I'd appreciate it." So he called over to 7th Army headquarters engineer section, and yes, they needed a draftsman, and I got transferred there. Spent 18 months in Stuttgart, which on the whole was a positive experience. It was still an army of occupation. We were not allowed to wear civvies on the street. I traveled with friends, with co-workers. As an adult, I realized how much of a German cultural education I had, and the books in the bookstores were the books that my parents had. Stuttgart had a terrific opera, 10 months a year, 6 days a week. So one of the cheapest forms of entertainment was 4 marks, which was $1, to go to the opera. And so we went to the opera quite frequently. I also met some young Germans, several who worked as secretaries and interpreters at the army headquarters, and through them others. And they were intelligent young people. They were very interested in finding out about their parents' generation, and I was very much interested in finding out about their parents' generation. So I had my civilian clothes at a friend's house. After work, went there, changed. We went out for dinner. I was repeatedly challenged by MPs. I spoke much better German than any of the MPs, so I was never caught. And so, on the whole, it was a positive experience.
I didn't think that you could be drafted if you weren't a United States citizen.
When you signed your intention of receiving your citizenship, which is what you sign when you sign your first papers, you are subject to the draft. What happened in that period is that since Korea was not a declared war, the immigration procedures did not change. You qualified for citizenship ahead of the normal 5 years if you served 3 years in the continental United States. Well, we were all drafted for 2 years, and we didn't serve in the continental United States. The Chinese in Korea captured a few people who were not citizens, and at least two of them were taken back to Poland and paraded through the Warsaw Pact countries as traitors, at which point Congress very quickly changed its rules to wartime rules, which means after 180 days of service without a dishonorable discharge, you qualified for citizenship. So for the Korean theater, they flew a federal judge to Tokyo, and all of these people were collected over one weekend and sworn in. In Europe, they didn't consider it that important, so we were told that as soon as we got back to the States, we could apply and qualify for citizenship.
So it's less than 5 years for normal.
Well, let's say about a year and a half, because I got out of the service in December 53, registered with the federal court. They were very polite. I mean, it was very interesting because I went through the immigration process, and in front of me was a Italian gentleman who hadn't taken out his citizenship for decades and decades, and he was really being pestered on why he had waited this long by the judge. And then my turn came, and the judge says, I see you served in the army. If called upon, would you serve again? And I said, yes, sir. And that was the only question. So they asked when would be. I was planning to go to Champaign, Illinois for Champaign-Urbana to start full-time at the University of Illinois. Asked me when would be convenient for me to come to Chicago to be sworn in. I was sworn in April 54. So, yes, I gained a year and a half. So, anyhow, I got out on the GI Bill and went to to study at the University of Illinois. It still took me 7.5 years, but I had a PhD after 7.5 years, not a bachelor's degree. And I didn't lose that much.
I have a question.
Yes.
The GI Bill was still...
The GI Bill, it was not as lucrative as World War II. I think $150 out of which you paid your $150 a month out of which you paid your own tuition and books. But since I had been drafted from Chicago, they accepted me as an in-state resident, so the tuition was absolutely minimal. So I started school that summer. First summer I was out of the service, I met my wife-to-be in Chicago. She and her sister-in-law and my sister had children, their first children very close together, and they were friends, and that way I met Norma. And we corresponded, I came up on weekends, and we were married in June of 1955.
What was her last name?
Horowitz.
Was it that name?
W-I-T-Z. She came down. I continued school because of all the irregular transfer credits, proficiency courses, etc. I didn't graduate in June of 56. I graduated in February 57. I was co-valedictorian of my class. Sat next to the commencement speaker, who was the junior senator from Massachusetts, John F. Kennedy.
Did you get to talk to him?
Yes, for a few minutes we chatted.
About anything that we need to know about?
No.
Okay.
And our first child, our son Greg, was born about 6 weeks after that.
No, before we talk about that, let's go back to your wife and tell us a little bit about your wife. I mentioned her maiden name. Where she came from and
Norma's parents, both immigrated with their parents at the early part of the century. Her mother's family came from Kiev. Her father was, I think, 12 when he came to the States, and he came from Latvia. He was a dentist, and they lived in Chicago. Mom has one brother, Bert Horowitz, an economist, teaches at SUNY Buffalo. Her sister-in-law was born in Vienna, was sent out to England at the just before the Anschluss, just before the German occupation of Austria, and then was reunited with her family in South America, and then they came to the States. Oh, that's our
bad
friend.
Cat.
That's our friendly cat.
Cat. Okay. Oh, no, I'm sorry, I interrupted you. You were talking about your child.
So, she was working as a secretary in Chicago when I met, and she got a job in Urbana at the university. And then our first son was born.
What's his name?
Gregory.
What year was that?
He was born in March 1957. So I got accepted. I started graduate school, and I didn't have any academic ambitions at that time. I wanted to be a designer of bridges, a designer of suspension bridges. But in order to support ourselves, I accepted a position as an instructor for the first year. And that sort of became extended for 12 years. I got into computers very early. I took my first programming course in 56 and became active in computer applications and civil engineering. And so I continued first for my master's and then for my PhD. I got my PhD in 1961. By that time we had Carol, who was born in 59, and Peter, who was born in 60. And so I accepted a position as assistant professor at the University of Illinois. We spent a year at MIT in 62-63, and I established a professional reputation very early. And so even though I was a few years behind, I was 30 when I got my PhD, but 3 years later I was a full professor, so I didn't lose much. So we lived in Champaign-Urbana, which is a university town. When kids got age 5 or thereabouts, we joined the one and only Jewish congregation there, Temple Sinai, and we became active in the temple. In 66, our fourth child, our daughter Laura, was born. And we spent a couple of summers at the University of Mexico, a sabbatical year at Cornell University. I had every intention to continue at the University of Illinois. I was very comfortable professionally and socially. We thought at that time we thought we were okay. Until I got an offer to become department head at Carnegie Mellon, and we came to Illinois in 72. I mean, we came to Pittsburgh in 72 as department head.
What department?
Civil engineering.
Okay. But we need a
We chose Mount Lebanon because everybody we consulted in Illinois, former Carnegie Tech graduates and the School of Education, everybody recommended Mount Lebanon as the place.
They didn't know that.
I looked at a house on one of the house hunting trips. I looked at a house on Shady, as a matter of fact, and it would have been three schools for four children and a lot of shuffling back and forth. And so we moved to Mount Lebanon. I've never regretted it. We lived from 72 till 86, 87. We lived in Mount Lebanon. Our kids got a first grade education. Our two boys were much more academically inclined than the two girls. They took advanced placement courses, et cetera, et cetera. They could have just as well done in the honors program in Alderdice. The two girls were bright, but not that motivated, and they would have done much more poorly at Alderdice. So we are all very grateful for Mount Lebanon. We like the community, we like the temple. We came from a background where if the kids had one other Jewish child in their class, that was unusual. So a young assistant rabbi came to Temple Emmanuel, and he met the kids before he met us. And when he met us, I understand you just came from somewhere else. Where did you come from? Where did your children acquire this terrific experience in Jewish leadership? And both of us sort of fell to the floor laughing because they acquired that in the youth group at Temple Emmanuel.
In
Mount Lebanon. I mean, that was the first time. I'm sure that whether they'd gone to Alderice or anywhere else, they would have fitted in with the Jewish crowd. And at Mount Lebanon Junior High and High School, they fitted in with the Jewish crowd, and there was never any question on who they were and where they belonged. But that came because the opportunity was there, not because that they had any prior exposure to essentially any kind of Jewish social life.
So, where did you live in
Manhattan? In Cedarhurst. So, all right, let's see, more or less chronologically. The department headship was a big bust. By that time, I had felt that my past was entirely behind me. I had a new life, a new family, a new profession. Months went by without ever thinking about the Holocaust at all. It got to the point where if I thought about it at all, I was thinking in the third person, as if that had happened to someone else. Until I became department head and was responsible for promotions, tenure, secretaries, letting go of secretaries, lab technicians, etc. And I just couldn't handle it. Absolutely could not handle it. Every personnel decision was another selection. Psychiatric help and everything else, but it just didn't work.
I'm not sure I understand the relationship between the
I had severe nervous breakdowns one after another.
Yeah, but it wasn't because of your position.
No.
That's what...
Yeah, I mean, I had, in my mind, I was doing a lousy job. I was failing in my job. I thought tenure revocation proceedings were perfectly in order. At a faculty meeting, after one of my students' PhD qualifying examination, I announced that he had failed, and in fact he had not failed. I was living in a totally different environment. I instinctively made the connection with the concentration camp, with the whatever sense of responsibility for survival of others that I acquired in the resistance organization. Help was very difficult to get. I went to the rabbi and asked him for advice about the psychiatrist. Oh yes, he knew this one. He knew that gentleman because the gentleman specializes in marital disputes. And his first question was, well, what does Norma think? I said, oh, Norma, please. The gentleman was an absolutely 100% pure Freudian. Said, how old were you when you were in concentration camp? I said, I was 13. He said, it is impossible that anything that was that late, that occurred that late in your life could have affected you in any way. Tell me about your father. that was the tone. I mean, other survivors had exactly the same experience of professionals who were totally unprepared.
You would think that at that point in time, I mean, you knew that this had to come out sometime.
Yeah, but I know of many other survivors who over the years have complained that that the psychiatric help that was available was just totally well, as soon as I announced to my dean and to the people that I was stepping down as the department head, they all, without exception, everybody asked me to stay on. I have stayed on for 20-some years since then. I think I've become a positive contributor to my profession and to my university, but it was a very trying time. And one of the byproducts of it was that I started speaking about my experiences. There's never any catharsis, never any self-revelation that comes out of that, but I was chairman of the Adult Education Committee for the South Hills, which included Bethel and Temple Emmanuel, and for the first time there was an interest in a short course about the Holocaust, and the lady presented, gave a short course, and she was absent she had to be absent from one of her talks, and I said, I'll step in and cover for her. That was the first time that Norma heard my story from beginning to end. We had talked about it. She has always been very supportive, but she also has been very sheltering all the years. So that was it. And she sat in the audience, as a matter of fact, she sat in the back the first time I made an attempt to give anything like what I gave you last time. And then the rabbi asked me to repeat that talk to the temple youth group.
Which rabbi?
Sejewitz. Okay. And so I gave a talk to the youth group, and it just so happened that three older children were in the audience, and that's the first time they heard any coherent, reasonably chronological account.
What was their reaction?
They were very moved. It wasn't a revelation. A total revelation.
Yeah.
They knew about my background. They knew about my tattoo. They knew that they didn't have grandparents on my side. They had been surrounded by my mother's etchings from the time they were born.
Your children.
Yes. In terms of hearing anything resembling a coherent story, that was the first time that happened.
You mentioned that it was not a catharsis for you. No.
No.
I'm surprised.
No, it never is. I mean, I speak anywhere from 4 to 15 times a year through the Speakers Bureau of the Holocaust Center. It's always painful. It's always, I know that I'll crack, my voice will crack a couple of times, but I never know where. But there's no catharsis, there's no self-revelation, there's no increased self-understanding. It's as difficult the 15th time as it is the first time. In fact, Laura, who is 6 years younger, she picked up pieces. But again, Carol was a junior at University of Michigan, and she took a course on the Holocaust from a gentleman who's now a dean at Brandeis, I forget his name. And she talked to one of the teaching assistants, and I got invited to give a talk to the class. And Laura came with me to Ann Arbor and sat in the audience, and that was the first time she's heard a story from beginning to end. We've always been very straightforward with the children. They are very sheltering, they're very supportive, but it wasn't a topic of daily conversation at the dinner table.